The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, everybody. Hey, happy Thursday. Glad to be with you. It's a pretty fall day here in Washington, D.C., and as always, a lot of activity buzzing in the nation's capital. We've got another good show for you today. I want to start off by talking about healthcare reform, and then we're going to go abroad a little bit and talk about the developing business opportunities in Iraq. We'll come back home and talk about new developments on the energy policy front, and then wrap up with the latest political headlines. But to start, obviously, if you've been watching the news, you know that Congress is hard at work on healthcare reform this week. And we have one of the leading experts in Washington, a frequent contributor here to Capital Thinking, Todd Tootin, here joining the show, stepping out of the halls of Congress to deliver the latest news to us. Todd, how are you today?
Doing well, thanks. We're in week two of the Senate Finance Committee health reform markup, so it's fast and furious.
Week two, and it probably only feels like week 12, right? I know those guys are burning the midnight oil, which means that you all are working almost around the clock on this. But let's sort of start with an update on where things stand in both chambers, what's been going on this week, and what's about to happen before they call it a week.
Well, this is the last committee, Kevin, of the five congressional committees that have to vote on health reform legislation. And this is probably the most conservative version of health reform that's been teed up to date. And there's been a good deal of back and forth in the amendment process, but we're expecting that by the end of the week, the committee will wrap up its work and is likely to report out a bill. In terms of timing, this bill in the Finance Committee has to be merged with the Senate Health Committee's bill. And over on the House side, there are three committees involved, and those three bills have to be merged by the House leadership.
Interesting. And we're, of course, talking about the Senate Finance Committee because the other Senate committee has done their work so far. And what about on the House side? What's happening over there?
Well, the leadership is watching the Senate action very closely and has said that it will not move forward until it's good and ready, essentially. I think, politically the goal is to avoid forcing centrist and conservative House Democrats, some of whom face tough re-election campaigns next year, to cast votes needlessly. And so the desire on the House side is to pull together a bill that will have enough votes to pass but will do the most political good and least political harm to Democratic members. That means timing-wise, you're probably looking at the end of October before the Senate bill in consolidated form is pulled together and the House leadership is able to basically assess the landscape.
So the House is not going to race out in front of the process. They're going to let the Senate take their time before they get a bill in front of people to vote. And you said some, I would say most centrist Democrats have to be very concerned about their election prospects with this vote in mind and with what's going on out there and just the general political landscape. But, well, Todd, let's get into some of the details of the bill. I get things crossing my email every couple hours here of updates, what amendments have passed, what they mean, which amendments have failed, and perhaps on the Senate Finance Committee process over the last 2 weeks, do you have a sense of who are the winners and losers are in the markup process?
Yeah, you know, it changes almost daily, but sort of who's up and who's down in the debate. I think, you know, overall, Republicans feel that they have been quite successful in forcing the committee to work at a more measured pace, to have full details of the proposals and related cost estimates, at least in draft form, available before a final vote occurs. And their messaging has been getting across on costs, on tax increases, on rationing of care, and on some other hot-button issues like illegal immigrants and abortion. You know, Democratic centrists on the committee have been wielding their considerable influence, determining the success or failure of various amendments, and given the close margins, of course, every vote counts. Some of the deal makers, the hospital sector and the pharmaceutical industry, that had agreements in place with Finance Chairman Baucus and with the administration, have seen those deals hold in the committee, at least so far. So there was an amendment to expand drug rebates to the Medicare drug benefit program, and that failed. That was opposed by the industry and by supporters of the deal that had been cut. Likewise, hospitals were able to get themselves exempted from review of their payment rates by this new independent Medicare commission, which will make recommendations that could have effect unless Congress overturns them. And I think it's not insignificant to note that the Congressional Budget Office stood up to some pretty withering criticism from the chairman about the timing involved in its cost estimates. CBO wants to get it right. It really remains the gatekeeper for any of these proposals. And now there is not going to be a final vote in the Finance Committee until about 3 days after the markup wraps up, so that members will have a chance at least to look at the conceptual language and a CBO draft estimate of it before the final vote. So, you know, those are the folks who are on the upside. And you could probably add seniors to the list because they've been exempted from a tax increase on their medical expenses and are potentially grandfathered in terms of their current Medicare Advantage coverage. That's an issue that's pending.
You mentioned, you said the word conceptual. I guess that's an important thing I'd like to talk to you about and educate people about. What's going on in the Finance Committee is what one of my friends called a conceptual markup. I mean, they're not necessarily looking at actual bill language in front of them as much as they're talking about concepts that will then be reduced to language later, right?
That's correct, and that's not unusual for the Finance Committee, given the technical nature of some of the issues, particularly tax issues, that it covers. You know, the positive way of spinning it is it's plain English, so anyone can read it and understand it. I think the negative way of spinning it is really the devil's in the details, and I mentioned the fact that hospitals will be exempted from this Medicare Commission review. That point was not apparent in the conceptual language. It only came out through a review of the actual legislative text, so the details do matter.
Yeah, they definitely do. And I want to go back to some of these amendments. It seems like you mentioned sort of a couple of things. Abortion, for example, I know there were several amendments offered. Are there a lot of political landmines being deliberately laid in this markup process for the 2010 election cycle?
Oh, clearly. Clearly. You know, I think members are standing on principle, but they're also, you know, political animals, and they recognize that this is an opportunity to start the debate that will continue into next year. There was, speaking of debate, there was an extended discussion of a public plan option to create essentially a government-sponsored plan as an alternative for individuals who lack health insurance. Two senators offered amendments, Senator Rockefeller and Senator Schumer. Both of them were defeated, and it was interesting to see that some of the centrist Democrats held firm against that. I mentioned Senator Carper earlier. He is now one of the key players on that issue, and looking at, as opposed to a federally sponsored or government-run plan, something at the state level that might be either a cooperative or a nonprofit or an expansion of state employee coverage. So the issue remains very much alive. It's been one of the most sensitive points in the debate. But for now, in the Finance Committee, the public plan advocates have been held in check.
Yeah, now there's obviously been so much coverage of the public plan debate. One of the things I see sort of coming up in the rearview mirror that's gotten a lot more attention in the last week or two is the question of whether or not a lot of this bill is financed on the back of Medicare reductions and what that means for seniors. And you've mentioned seniors were winners just a minute ago, and I guess I was wondering if you'd talk a little more about the intersection between Medicare cuts and senior interests here.
No, I think that's a really key question, Kevin. You know, seniors have been winners in the amendment debate, but in the underlying bill, obviously there are a number of reductions in Medicare payments to providers and other policy changes affecting Medicare managed care coverage that could have a real impact on seniors' benefits and cost sharing. A great effort has been made by Chairman Baucus and the Democrats to soften the impact of any of those cuts, but that's an issue that seems to be gaining additional resonance. And, you know, in the final analysis, seniors and some of their advocacy organizations like AARP will have to decide whether what comes to the Senate floor or the House floor is a net win for seniors. And I think that's an open question at this point.
And, Todd, you mentioned these deals the White House has with various groups. Seems like the drug companies have managed to lay low in the Finance Committee markup. They have their deal with the White House, but I sense when you see Rockefeller talk about the deal that the hospitals had with the White House that a lot of Democrats are uneasy with the deals that have been cut and it doesn't seem like it would take much for them to back out of those deals.
Well, you know, there are a number of progressive members in both the House and the Senate who have no love for any of the deals and are quite willing to try and undo them. So the question is whether when amendments are offered on the floor of the Senate or the House, that require, you know, offsets for increased spending or benefits, you know, whether those deals will hold. And it's very unclear at this point. I think what's certain is that the budget rules are going to hold. And so the considerable pressure to find additional sources of savings may, for example, drive members back to the Medicare Drug Benefit Program rebate idea.
Interesting. All right. A 10-second answer, Todd. When does this bill reach the president's desk?
Oh, that's a tough one. I will say not before close to year-end. I think the holidays are going to be the real trigger date here. And it may well take a substantially scaled-back form and a different budgetary vehicle.
All right. We'll end it there. We'll be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-
457-6000. It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle. Whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business. live from Washington. It's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Well, the president is abroad late this week pitching the United States for the Olympic Games in 2016, and the president's got his hands full with a very busy scene in the Middle East. We wanted to take you back to the Middle East for this segment to talk a little bit about business opportunities that might be available for you in the nation of Iraq. And joining us is a friend and colleague of mine, Dave Tafuri, a partner in international business at the law firm of Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C., and a guy who did a great civic duty for the United States, spent 15 months in Iraq working for the Department of State as the rule of law coordinator at the United States Embassy in Baghdad. So, Dave, welcome to the show for the first time. Happy to have you here today.
Thanks for having me on, Kevin.
Well, Dave, what caught my eye was you had a great article in Business Week a couple weeks ago about 10 things that we needed to know about doing business in Iraq, and I thought that was a fantastic article, and we should get you on to talk about some of the things. So let's kind of start at the top and tell me a little bit about, I know as an investor interested in where the world economy is going, it's probably not the first place that jumps to mind to invest my money. Tell me why now is a good time to think about investing in Iraq.
Well, Kevin, investing in Iraq is not for the faint of heart. There's certainly some risk involved, but right now it's a great time to look at Iraq. Here's why. First of all, security has improved in Iraq to a significant extent. Second, Iraq is going to be a very wealthy country. It has the second largest oil reserves in the world. And as oil production increases, it's going to have a substantial budget to pay for all types of services and products. And third of all, in Iraq right now, there are really great opportunities for foreign companies. Iraq is really looking to promote foreign investment, and they need pretty much everything. The infrastructure in Iraq has been completely destroyed by sanctions and war. So there's a market for almost every product and service.
Sounds like one of those places where there's a significant first-mover advantage, right?
Exactly.
Well, Dave, you obviously spent a lot of time there, and you understand the country very well, and you said it's not for the faint of heart. So walk me through what a potential investor needs to think about when looking at business opportunities there in Iraq.
Sure. First of all, an investor should think about whether they want to do business with the government of Iraq or whether they want to do business with Iraqi companies. Now, the private sector in Iraq is growing, but it doesn't have a substantial presence yet. So the best opportunities still continue to be with the government of Iraq and with the public sector. But there's potential for public-private partnerships and joint venturing with the government of Iraq, and of course just entering into contracts with the government of Iraq. However, if a company is interested in commercial activity in Iraq and is ready to sell in Iraq, there are some great private Iraqi companies that foreign companies can also partner with. Any company that's investing in Iraq wants to look very carefully at the political situation, particularly in the area of Iraq where they're planning to do business. As I mentioned, security has improved a lot, but there are still some areas that are dangerous, like in Mosul, for instance. But other areas, like Baghdad, have improved. And in the south, in southern Iraq, in, for instance, Karbala and Najaf, it's pretty safe, and there are some great business opportunities there and not many foreign companies. Of course, I also should mention the Kurdistan region of Iraq in the north, which is very safe. They haven't had a foreigner or Westerner injured or killed since 2003 in that area. So it's quite safe up there, and there are a lot of foreign companies up there now.
And in that area, that's a semi-autonomous province. Is it a little bit different in terms of doing business up there compared to the rest of the country?
It is a little bit different, and that goes to the point about really getting to know the political situation and context for the particular area of Iraq where a company is considering doing business. The Kurdistan region is semi-autonomous. It has a regional government that is separate from the federal government in Baghdad. They communicate with each other, but doing business with one means you're not doing business with the other potentially. And the opportunities are a little bit different. The Kurdistan region also has a separate budget, and it has some different laws and rules relating to foreign investment.
Interesting. Well, I know you're spending a lot of time working with folks who want to get into that market. So talk to me a little bit about what you do on a day-to-day basis to help Acme Corporation penetrate the Iraqi market, find the right place to do business, and actually get up and running.
Sure. One of the best ways, really, to assist a foreign company, especially an American company interested in doing business in Iraq, is to have them get involved with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We at Patton Boggs actually represent the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the U.S. Chamber has started a business council called the Iraq Business Initiative. There are a number of American companies that are already doing business in Iraq that use the business initiative to make contacts in Iraq. And the business initiative has been a really great forum for bringing in Iraqi business leaders and Iraqi government officials to meet with U.S. businesses. And they conduct a number of business-to-business meetings and really facilitate direct discussions on specific opportunities. The U.S. Chamber has also been very successful in advocating for more pro-business policies in Iraq with the government of Iraq and also with the U.S. government, and has had some success on behalf of a number of their companies in promoting investments. So that's one of the first things that I recommend a company consider, and I work a lot with the U.S. Chamber and with the companies that are members of the U.S. Chamber.
Now, Dave, that's, to me, kind of interesting. I think of the U.S. Chamber as very active in Washington, representing Main Street business, everything from mom and pop to the Fortune 500 on big issues of the day here at all levels of government. I don't often think of them as out there representing American businesses to other countries, let alone a place like Iraq. So tell us a little bit more about the role that they play in reaching out and helping businesses here.
Absolutely. Well, the U.S. Chamber has a very large international division that is very much committed to what you mentioned, which is assisting U.S. companies in doing business in foreign countries. They have a pretty big presence in the Middle East, and they have councils that are dedicated to specific countries. For instance, we also work with the U.S.-India Business Council, which assists companies with doing business in India. But essentially what the U.S. Chamber can do is advocate on behalf of companies collectively, one voice for American business that really helps push forward on various rules or regulations or obstacles to doing investment. And it's a lot easier, and it can be more effective for there to be one voice on behalf of a number of companies rather than an American company having to come out on its own and advocate to a foreign government or foreign businesses about specific issues that are making it difficult for them to do business in a foreign country and make a profit.
And Dave, you mentioned earlier that the infrastructure in the country is one of the golden opportunities there because of the devastation that's been visited and also just decades of neglect under the regime of Saddam Hussein. What other real significant market sectors, if I'm a businessman listening here at the office, should really be thinking about getting involved here?
Well, construction and housing is a big sector. We actually had the Minister of Housing and Construction from Baghdad in town yesterday morning, and she suggested that they need 2 million new homes in Iraq. Certainly, education, hospitals, health care are very much needed in Iraq. There's a great need in the energy sector to increase oil production, natural gas. There are a number of oil companies in the U.S. that are interested in Iraq. Few are doing business there. Many more want to do business. There are great opportunities across the board in the oil and energy sector in Iraq. Defense and security is also a big sector in Iraq, and there are great opportunities there as well. And agriculture is also a substantial sector that needs development in Iraq. Iraq really used to be the breadbasket of the Middle East, produced a lot of crops and products, food products, and it doesn't really do that anymore. That really deteriorated under Saddam Hussein, And Iraq has really marked that as an industry sector that they want to increase. So they're looking for foreign investment in agriculture as well.
Well, now, I know we mentioned at the top, I want to mention again for our listeners that Dave had a terrific article in Business Week just 2 weeks ago that has more details on sort of his top 10 reasons to get out there and get involved with the business community in Iraq. But Dave, I think you've got plans for to participate in a large investment conference on Iraq that's going to take place later in October in Washington, D.C. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Thank you for mentioning it. On October 20th and 21st, there will be an investment summit conference in Washington, D.C. for Iraq. It is being planned by the Department of State, Department of Commerce, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and also the Department of Defense as well, and in conjunction with the country of Iraq and with the commercial attaché's office here in Washington, D.C. It's going to be a very large conference with approximately 500 participants. Almost 250 people are coming over from Iraq for the conference, including some of the high-level business leaders who are involved in guiding the economy in Iraq, as well as more than 100 Iraqi business leaders. So it'll be a great conference, and there'll be a lot of dialogue about how to improve investment in Iraq and increase foreign investment in Iraq. So that conference is on October 20th and 21st in Washington, D.C., and anyone who's interested in participating or attending should contact the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Okay, well, that sounds... Dave, I got about 30 seconds left. I'd be interested in a quick story about your favorite memory of the Iraqi people from your time over there.
Well, Kevin, I was there in 2006 and 2007, and it was one of the most dangerous times in Iraq's recent history. And, you know, one of the most amazing parts about my experience was seeing the commitment of the Iraqis who worked with us, the U.S. and coalition countries, at great peril to their own lives. And there are a lot of committed Iraqis over there who really want Iraq to become a stable country. And now that it's starting to be on that path, it's great to see and great to watch. But really the best part was getting to know some of the committed Iraqis who are still there working to make Iraq a stable country.
Well, folks, check out Dave Tafuri's article in Business Week a couple weeks ago. Look into that Iraqi investment conference via the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We'll be back in a minute to talk about the energy bill and climate change.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Merhaba.
From Denver to
Hello.
Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington.
Washington. It's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to the show. Well, President Obama has three major domestic policy initiatives that we've focused on this show on this year. We spent a lot of last week talking about recent stimulus developments, and of course we've spent time earlier this show and most other shows this summer and fall talking about health care reform. Perhaps operating a little further below the radar for the average American is the president's focus on climate change legislation, and we've had some recent developments in that here in Congress this week, and wanted to revisit the issue with our leading expert and contributor to the show, and that's Jeff Turner, the co-chair of the Public Policy Department at the law firm of Patton Boggs in Washington, and a noted guru on the issue of energy policy. So, Jeff, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks, Kevin.
Well, I know that we've got some action in the Senate where Barbara Boxer and John Kerry have introduced their bill this week. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on there?
Sure. They've been talking for quite some time about putting in legislation that would be an extension of what the House did earlier this summer when it adopted the so-called Waxman-Markey bill. The Clean Energy Jobs and American Power Act, put forward by Senator Kerry and Senator Boxer, does have some parallels with the House bill. I think the consideration of this bill is going to be rather problematic in the Senate, not least because the proposed legislation actually goes farther than the House bill in encouraging even greater reductions of greenhouse gas emissions by 2020 than the president has recently called for or even the House. And so this is as green a bill as you're going to see, and I think the process now will be to move it back in a direction in which industry can live with it.
Well, you mentioned it's much more ambitious than the House legislation. I thought it was interesting, tell me if I've read this correctly, that what's notable about the Senate bill is that it's both more ambitious, but also that it leaves out some very big things that the House bill had in their version.
Yes, and it's been the number one issue all along has been how will so-called allowances be allocated. The House bill, when the initial draft of the Waxman-Markey bill came out, those two chairmen also did not include that provision. It was added only at the end, and we're seeing a repeat of that here. It's in part because the two senators need more time to speak with their colleagues. This is really a case in which the devil is in the details, and for most folks, they won't be able to make a judgment about the bill until they see those details.
Very interesting. So things like that are often left out to allow horse trading to go on.
Well, it's pretty rare, actually, for bills to be introduced without key elements of them. So far, the bill hasn't actually been introduced, as I can tell. It's up on Senator Kerry's website being described as introduced. But it will be marked up in the next 2 or 3 weeks in the Environment and Public Works Committee. I think part of the reason for leaving out some of the key elements of the bill is to give other committees with jurisdiction an opportunity to weigh in. The Senate Finance Committee, as your listeners know, has been in health care hell for the better part of 2 weeks and hadn't had time to contribute anything with respect to a climate change bill. Senator Baucus, the chairman of that committee, has talked about producing a climate change bill, or at least essential elements of one, and focused in particular on the allowance allocation issue. But I'm assuming at this point, frankly, that that's a better part than a month or perhaps even 2 months away.
Now, Jeff, one of the things that seems a lot different that perhaps is interesting to explain to listeners is that the political differences in representing an entire state on the Senate side as compared to representing a district of 600,000 or so on the House side really do fundamentally shift the debate here on the Senate for big issues like this. Can you talk a little bit about the role of Midwestern and Southerners as compared to their party affiliation?
Yeah, I think as on every other energy bill that's ever come before the Congress, the party affiliation is not particularly relevant in identifying where and how a member will vote. Much more important is the type of constituents they represent. I think this bill could not gain the support of probably even a majority of the Senate right now, let alone a supermajority of 60, which is what it will ultimately require in order to be enacted, largely because senators, Democrats, and Republicans from red states are going to find it very difficult to vote for a bill that's perceived to benefit entities on the west coast of the United States and the east coast at the expense of the Midwest. That was a common theme we heard in the House there, as you point out, where members represent a smaller district than an entity, namely a district, as opposed to an entire state. You saw some of that at work here with senators, 13 Democratic senators, for example, represent states that Senator McCain carried in the election. Those are red states by definition. It would be very difficult for members, especially those up in 2010, to vote for a bill that would be seen or perceived to raise prices on consumers for gasoline, electricity, and that could be perceived as exporting jobs overseas.
Now, Jeff, obviously the House is passing a bill, set a baseline for some of the changes that that are on the table here in this debate, and now the Senate is introduced or is about to introduce their bill. Can you look sort of sector by sector at some of these major energy players like gas, coal, nuclear, wind, solar, and manufacturing, and say who are what are some of them really looking for? What do they have to have in order to agree that they'll support a bill like this?
Well, I think you have many companies in the electric utility industry, for example, that simply want certainty. They'd like a bill. I think they would take a tougher bill than other industries would accept simply because they need the certainty and for the future, knowing what kinds of power plants to build, what kind of profile, knowing what kind of emissions caps they're going to be subject to. Other industries, refining petroleum industry did not do well in the House bill. They're not treated particularly well in this bill. They're going to likely oppose the bill. Natural gas industry does not believe that it has gotten a sufficient amount of allowances, and these are the for free, so that the impact is less painful in the early years. So there's going to be widespread, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers are going to continue to oppose the bill and oppose it vigorously. You'll see individual companies that just see the value of doing something in part because they think it's the right thing to do and in part because they simply need certainty in planning for the next couple decades.
Yeah, you mentioned the Chamber, and I had run across an article in preparing for the show this week last day or two that mentioned that a number of large energy companies have actually dropped their membership or are not going to renew their membership in the Chamber because of the schism of the Chamber's opposing the energy reform bills in their current form, and these companies have decided that they want the certainty. How will that affect the debates going forward?
I don't think it will fundamentally change the debate. Those companies were still in there. Many of them, not all of them, in their individual capacity have been lobbying in favor of the bill. I think this is in part they've made a decision that they do not want to be part of an organization that's opposed to something that's really fundamental from their perspective, and that's getting a good climate change bill enacted. I still think that, as I said at the outset, this bill has a very difficult road ahead of it, and I would be very, very surprised if the bill even gets to the floor this year, given the likely opposition to it in its current form.
Well, so now the president is off to Denmark today to push for the United States to win the 2016 Olympics, and I believe he's got a return engagement later this fall to go out and talk with the rest of the world community on long scheduled environmental talks, and is your sense that he'll be going to those talks later this year empty-handed because of congressional failure to pass something, or will the fact that they've introduced something give him ammunition to be a key player at the table?
I think the United States, when it gets to the UN Copenhagen talks in December, you're right, it's ironic, but going back to the same cities heading to try to win the Olympics for Chicago and the country, his administration will be back in Copenhagen in December, where the UN and its members are trying to negotiate a successor to the Kyoto Protocol, which is the existing international framework for regulating emissions of greenhouse gas emissions. That's the Kyoto Protocol was never ratified by the U.S. government because of opposition in the United States Senate. The president has been working very hard through a variety of multilateral forums to try to encourage countries to come together on an agreement. He gave a major address last week at the UN encouraging governments to come together, made a big part of the G20 summit meeting in Pittsburgh about climate change. We are seeing movement by other governments, but in my view, not sufficient movement collectively by the governments in order to be able to reach consensus. In December, the president will not show up empty-handed. If you listen to the rhetoric in the White House and others talking already, they're pointing out that the House has already adopted a bill. They expect that the Kerry Boxer bill will have been favorably reported by the Environment and Public Works Committee. So the president will be able to go into Copenhagen in December saying we're making great progress in the United States. Largely because of the time spent on health care, there wasn't sufficient time to consider climate change legislation in the Senate. But if the world moves forward, he'll be confident that he can come back to the United States and get the Senate to do the right thing.
Very good. Just last question. I got about 20 seconds left, Jeff. Will they eventually separate the carrots from the sticks in this bill just to get something in the research and development area?
There will be temptation to do it. We think that separation is more likely to happen next year, and that a traditional energy bill will get done next year, and that a more comprehensive climate change bill will not be complete. Action won't be completed until 2011 or 2012. The stakes are just too big, and so it's going to take time to work through.
Excellent. Well, we'll leave it there. If you want more information, Jeff Turner's email address is jturner@pattenboggs.com. We'll come back in just a moment with the latest political headlines from Washington. You're listening to Capital Thinking here on the Voice America Network.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, @pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, everybody, welcome back. I can't believe it's already October. I wanted to spend a few more weeks in flip-flops and shorts at the pool, and that has passed us by a few weeks ago, and now we're definitely headlong into fall, and my little ones are talking about what to be for Halloween. So the fall is a busy time. Things are going so quickly here in D.C., we hardly know that notices that days are passing us by. Well, I want to talk about a variety of things. President Obama getting ready to wing his way to Denmark to be the advocate-in-chief for a pitch for Chicago to host the 2016 Olympic Games. It's become a little bit of a political football in the last few days. The president announced his decision on Monday after just a couple weeks ago saying he would not travel to the Games because he was to the competition for the Games because he was too engaged in the details of the health care reform fight. Now he's done a 180 and said that, health care reform fight's going well. I can afford to leave the country for a day and pitch this. And a lot of Republicans have piled on saying that's inappropriate. I disagree. Getting the games is a multi-billion-dollar endeavor that's good for a variety of American companies. It would be great for redevelopment opportunities in Chicago. It would be great for the American companies that are largely the biggest sponsors of the Olympic Games, who would value the marketing opportunities of being here in the United States. It's great for whatever American-based network is going to be the television host for the Olympic Games, because it means they could set the schedule to allow the marquee events to appear in American primetime, draw the biggest ratings. I think it's appropriate, especially in light of the economic conditions of this country, for our chief executive to get on a plane where, by the way, you know, he's probably got a fax machine and a phone. It turns out he can work on the way over there, work on the way back, sleep as needed. This is a guy who can work from anywhere in the world. Let's get him over there and let's put our A game together and bring the Olympic Games home. It'll been 20 years between 1996 Olympics in Atlanta and 2016 in Chicago, if we get them. There's no guarantee we're going to get them, and that's where I think President Obama faces some interesting political risk, because he has now spent a lot of political capital on going over there and wooing a pretty closed set of International Olympic Committee delegates. These are people from all over the world who don't have an open, transparent voting process. If you remember a few years ago, it wasn't but about a decade or so ago that the IOC was the subject of some pretty intense bribery scandals, where it turns out these delegates were accepting free trips and gifts from cities wooing them for the purpose of getting their vote. And you say, well, maybe times have changed. I hope they have, but it's not clear that we are the front runners and that the president will be the difference maker. Looks like, if you read the media closely, it looks like the city of Chicago's biggest competition is Rio. And, of course, South America has never actually hosted an Olympic Games, and there'll be significant sentimental pressure to give them the first this first opportunity to host a Games. So if the president goes over and it turns out we don't win, I support his going over. I think it's the right thing to do. But I think he'll take a little political hit if he goes over and it turns out he couldn't woo these folks to give the games to Chicago. Because remember, one of the reasons that he campaigned so hard on was that he was going to convince the international community to rebuild its relationship with the United States. And certainly awarding the Olympic Games would have been one of those indicators. So I believe they'll make a decision tomorrow, and we'll know pretty quickly, if I'm not mistaken, on who wins and not. So we'll see the fruits of his labor. I wish Chicago good luck. I may not agree with some of the political players out there and some of the decisions they make, but I think most Americans would agree that we'd like the opportunity for the Games to be in the United States again. Well, some interesting controversies breaking out in the House of Representatives this week. You remember the Joe Wilson controversy, claiming, standing up at the President's joint address and shouting out, "You lie," during the President's health care reform address to Congress a few weeks ago. This week we have another similar incident on the Democratic side, but this comes from the sort of daily and normal debate that members have on the House floor. We've got a member from Orlando, Florida, named Alan Grayson, Democrat, one of those people who is politically vulnerable in this election cycle, and somebody who's actually serving his first term in Congress, got in with just 52% of the vote from an Orlando area that George Bush carried in two elections, but President Obama carried last time. Grayson got up and talked about, as a Democrat, talked about what he saw the Republican health care reform plan, what it was, and he said that their plan was for people to die quickly. And then later in follow-up remarks yesterday on CNN, Grayson said not only wouldn't he apologize, but he called his political opposition, the Republican Party, a bunch of knuckle-draggers and Neanderthals. And that has ignited another round of sort of controversy here in Washington. And I think it's what a lot of people hate most about Washington is the name-calling and the senselessness that's consumed, all the time that's consumed with those types of things, when reasonable people who have real jobs in the real world could never get away with calling somebody who sits around a table and negotiates with them and disagrees with them a knuckle-dragging Neanderthal whose end objective is to kill a lot of Americans more quickly. Grayson has said he will not apologize. Speaker Pelosi has said she will not make him apologize. Republicans are planning potentially to introduce a resolution of disapproval, just like was done with Joe Wilson, to force the issue, and it's more that sort of gotcha politics that I don't think people really, really like. Just as we encouraged Joe Wilson to get out of this story by going to the House floor and apologizing, and he chose not to do so, we'd say the same thing to Alan Grayson. We can agree to disagree as Americans politically, but let's not say that people really want to kill a bunch of other Americans just because they don't want to have a government-run health system. I don't think that's the kind of dialogue we should be having as a democracy. Interesting developments on the 2012 election and one sort of post-mortem on the 2008 election. If you're a big political junkie, I encourage you to get to Politico.com today and read their story on the downfall of John Edwards and his relationship with the staffer who ultimately may have been the conduit between John Edwards and the woman with which he had an affair. This is the guy who stepped forward and say, "Oh, I had the affair and fathered this child out of wedlock." That guy is now writing a book, and he and the Edwards family are at bitter ends. But very interesting read to see how Edwards was running for president and all of this was going on internally below there. But Tim Pawlenty, who's the governor of Minnesota, making a lot of news today, also in Politico.com, talking about putting together an ambitious team of White House veterans and national electoral veterans that are coming together as sort of the basis for what looks like a 2012 presidential bid. And what this article speculates about, and I think is pretty true, is that 3 years out, it looks as if the Republican presidential race is going to have two fairly significant heavyweights battling, and it's not clear that there'll be a lot of other players. Those two heavyweights are Mitt Romney, who I think started running the day after the election last year. It probably has no intention of slowing down, and Governor Pawlenty of Minnesota. And Pawlenty seems to be drawing a lot of the Bush veterans from 2000 and 2004. And, you know, Pawlenty was on the short list, as was Romney, to be the vice president, a presidential nominee with John McCain this past summer. Pawlenty served as the host for the Republican National Convention in 2008 and is a two-term governor who's stepping down, not running for re-election. That's going to be an interesting, fascinating political battle to see how these veterans split between the two campaigns and start squaring off. And we're 3 years out, people, 3 years and a month until Election Day. Well, that's going to do it for our show today. I hope everybody has a great weekend of college and pro football. We will be back with you next Thursday with more developments from Capitol Hill. Until then, thanks for listening to Capitol Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.